From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect Mike Pence are expected to meet today in New York to talk about appointments for key jobs in their administration as different names float like trial balloons. Rudy Giuliani, once thought a shoo-in for Attorney General, told the Wall Street Journal last night he would not take that job. He also said former U.S. Ambassador John Bolton would be great as Secretary of State and then hinted that he, Giuliani, would be great, too. And one person has taken himself out of the process. Mike Rogers, a former congressman from Michigan, announced today he's resigning from the transition team where he handled national security matters. NPR's political reporter Scott Detrow is here. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Robin.
So what more do we know about this meeting between Trump and Pence today?
Well, we don't know too much, and that's been kind of the basic theme of this transition. We know that Mike Pence is in charge of the transition team, and at this point in time, kind of the key priority is figuring out who those key players in an administration are. So I think we can assume, and a spokesperson said this could be the case, that they'll be talking about some of those appointments, Secretary of State, Attorney General, the people that you plan your entire administration around. But they've got a lot of work to do. And the fact that Mike Pence just took over from Chris Christie late last week in running this transition means that they're kind of behind the ball here. They need to speed things up in making these decisions.
Right. And by the way, has there been any reaction from the campaign to the backlash to the appointment of Steve Bannon as chief strategist because of his ties to Breitbart News and its ties to white nationalists?
They have been defending Steve Bannon, and I think what's more notable than what you're hearing from the campaign is what you're hearing from people like Speaker Paul Ryan. In addition to being kind of somebody who promoted white nationalist movements as the head of Breitbart, Steve Bannon went really hard after Paul Ryan. They really boosted his primary opponent this summer, trying to oust Paul Ryan in a primary. But asked about it today, Paul Ryan said, "This is someone who is close to Trump. He's basically allowed to make his own appointments. We will judge this administration on its results."
Well,
so no backlash from Paul Ryan right there.
Well, he spoke today as Republicans are voting on leadership. He's expected to be nominated to stay on as Speaker. We have a clip of him here speaking before that vote.
Welcome to the dawn of a new unified Republican government. Feels really good to say that, actually. This will be a government focused on turning President-elect Trump's victory into real progress for the American people.
Scott, is this surprising to you, or maybe politics as usual? Because he was, you know, at loggerheads with Donald Trump during the campaign.
Well, winning the White House and winning both chambers of Congress and realizing you can do a lot of what you want to do, I think, changes a mind real quick. There was a powerful visual in addition to that powerful quote from Paul Ryan, and that was that he and other members of Republican leadership were standing there at the lectern with Make America Great Again red hats. I mean, they at the moment are all on board with Donald Trump's administration. They think they can get a lot of the big picture things they've done, like tax policy, through. And they're just turning the page on the harsh continued criticism that Ryan and other key congressional Republicans had for Trump throughout the campaign.
But within the campaign, we're seeing reports of infighting over the names that will be nominated. That this may also be common as, you know, people come into the White House. But we're seeing conflicting reports as well from different news agencies about whether Donald Trump is asking for security clearance for his kids. NPR hasn't confirmed this, and the Trump campaign is denying this. But it gets to the larger issue of how involved his family members, who are also his business partners, should be with his political career. What are you hearing?
Well, the big picture thing, and you're right, that is not something NPR has confirmed. And I think at a point in time when there's a lot of leaks, a lot of strategic leaks happening as people jostle for position, you need to weigh all of those leaks carefully. And that's what we're doing. But there's no question that Trump's children have been his top advisors, among his top advisors. And throughout his campaign, and they have key positions with the transition team. Now, Trump has also said that they will take care of running his business. So there's a real question here of any actual or perceived conflict of interest, because even though there are no hard rules requiring it, typically when presidents take power, they disassociate themselves from their business interests. So there's no perception that they're working to enrich themselves in addition to run the country. So the question is, how separate will those business interests be if his children are running them, but also continuing to advise him in government, even though they are barred by law from taking any official government positions?
Right. and this is the call for a blind trust, that all of his holdings be put in a blind trust, which initially during the campaign, he and his at least one son misunderstood to mean that that means that the children run it. A blind trust means a complete outsider would run the companies, and so far that's been rejected. Yeah. Scott, one last question, very quick.
Yes.
What do you make of the resignation of a member of the transition team?
I think that's something to keep an eye on. Roger's statement was very smooth, saying that you know he is honored by the work. He looks to keep working with them, but there's a lot of rumblings of some tensions there. Specifically, the ouster of Chris Christie, who had been running this for several months. Rogers was brought in with Christie. Christie's gone. Rogers is gone too. Yeah. We'll look to see if that trend continues.
NPR political reporter Scott Detrow, thank you.
Sure thing.
Well, during his press conference yesterday, President Obama urged President-elect Donald Trump to think long and hard before endangering the young immigrants who have been protected from deportation through his executive action, people whose parents brought them to the U.S. as children. It was an answer to a reporter's question about whether Obama could shield the 750,000 or so immigrants who provided the government with identification when they applied for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. As Armando Truhl from Here and Now contributor WAMU in Washington, D.C. reports, many of them are worried.
There's no telling what's going to happen to me when, you know, my work permit expires.
30-year-old Mary Beth Onyeku was born in Nigeria, and her parents brought her to Washington, D.C. when she was two. Her father was on a student visa that expired 4 years later. She says the family decided to stay without papers instead of returning to a country racked with violence.
We lost our immigration status, but I didn't find out about this until I was 13. So which really changed my entire perspective because I don't remember Nigeria at all. I don't have any point of reference for that country. So to have to grapple with its reality that I'm undocumented, that I can be removed, was very unsettling.
21-year-old Claudia Quiñones and her mother came from Bolivia almost 11 years ago and settled in Hyattsville, Maryland, after overstaying their visa. Quiñones says it was difficult to live in the shadows. Her friends got driver's licenses. She couldn't. They paid in-state tuition for college. She couldn't. And always the fear that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, could arrest her.
It was tough because I felt American. I was an American kid growing up and studying in the American school system. But I wasn't really one because I didn't have a Social Security number.
Then, 4 years ago, President Obama signed an executive order called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It granted these involuntary immigrants temporary protection from deportation and work papers if they came out of the shadows and applied for the program. Quiñones says DACA opened unexpected doors.
It was a blessing. I was able to get a driver's license. I'm actually in my last year getting my political science degree. And, you know, I know that I wouldn't have been able to accomplish what I have. And it's all thanks to DACA.
But in order to apply for DACA, you have to turn yourself into the immigration agency. Mary Beth Onyeku did and says now she feels exposed.
The way that it's set up when you apply for DACA, you provide all of your information so they know where I live, they know my connections, they know where I work, they have access to my bank accounts, they have all of that information.
Onyeku says she's worried agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, will come knocking.
The reality that my work permit can expire and the next day, you know, ICE shows up at my door.
Some immigration reformers support the end of DACA. They say it was an abuse of executive authority.
And what President Obama did was create unrealistic expectations for people who've been here illegally for some period of time.
Dan Stein is the president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a conservative think tank that's concerned about what it calls the harmful impact of uncontrolled immigration. Stein says the Trump administration will need to clean up the expectations created by DACA.
We're going to encourage him to take a humane, constructive approach to these issues. But at the same time, we also realize that if you reward people who broke the rules in front of those people who respected our system, you're striking at the heart of the fundamental fairness that animates all of American democracy.
About 100 immigrant activists and supporters from all over the country are shouting, "Yes, we can," in Spanish, at the Civic Center in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. They gathered here 2 days after Trump's election to discuss next steps. Ana Sol Gutierrez is a Maryland state delegate from Montgomery County.
I think we have to learn lessons from what's happened in other times when populations were under threat. Going back to the Jewish community in Germany, I think we need to know that these individuals have to be protected and they have to not be accessible when somebody comes to knock on their doors.
Immigration activists and lawyers say their offices have been swamped with calls from concerned DACA recipients. At this point, advocates are telling the youth to sit tight and wait for more details, and to begin planning for the possibility that after 4 years of living openly, a repeal of DACA may drive them out of the country or back into the shadows. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl.
A new book out today dives deep into the world of McDonald's. It's about Ray Kroc, who built it into a global empire, and his wife Joan, who gave their fortune away, including $200 million to NPR. The book is called Ray and Joan. It's by Lisa Napoli, formerly of Public Radio's Marketplace. Lisa, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeremy.
And we have so much to talk about here with these two people, but let's go back to the early history of the McDonald's chain, because I have always thought that the first McDonald's was in Des Plaines, Illinois, but as you point out, it's in Southern California.
Yes. And many people think that because, of course, they call it the first McDonald's restaurant in Des Plaines. If you ever have traveled through there, it's set up as a little mini museum. But no, it started in San Bernardino, California. Actually, it started even before that over in Monrovia. And there were two brothers named McDonald. And they were seizing the moment as the suburbs developed, Southern California's roadsides developed. And they, like many people, saw a future in making hamburgers.
And they were really innovative. They had perfected assembly line food production, paper goods instead of glass and china. Tell us about some of the things that they were doing that were so new and important in the business they were getting into.
Right. These guys, in order to cut costs, Dick and Mac McDonald's sat there and looked at how they could move the hamburger, move the fries, move the shakes through the system fast enough so that they could compete with all the other roadside hamburger stands by getting the food to the people as quickly as possible. And so this little assembly line that they came up with was very precise. It was choreographed really well, and it distinguished them from the others and created a terrific customer base for them and set them apart from the others.
And enter Ray Kroc, who was a multi-mixer salesman, which McDonald's used for its milkshakes. How did he get involved?
Ray was selling these six-spindled multi-mixers, and the multi-mixers were designed to help make as many shakes as possible. And of course, the McDonald's brothers not only had one, they ordered a number of them, and that sort of put them on Ray's radar even more specifically. So he went to pay a visit and was so blown away by this choreographed dance of the hamburger that he went to the brothers and said, "Hey, look, I think this is a great idea. Let's sell it elsewhere."
And they did expand, and eventually he actually bought them out.
Yes, he did. He bought them out. They went off into the sunset, literally. They never really did much again. And he took it and ran with it and grew it and grew it bigger and bigger.
And by the way, spoiler alert, McDonald's did very well. Ray Kroc made a lot of money. And we'll get to what happened with that money later. But one of the things that amazed me was these guys, Mac and Dick McDonald, ended up with what? $12 million or something like that, and he ended up with billions.
Right. You know, it's one of those things we were familiar with the dot-com days. You know, somebody invents a piece of technology and sells it out to Microsoft, and Microsoft turns it into a multi-billion dollar affair. That's exactly what happened here. Ray asked the brothers to name their price to go away. And the brothers said, "Hey, you know, we'll take $2,700,000, $1 million for each of us and $700,000 to pay the taxes." That's how practical they were. And they were happy with that. They never expressed dismay that they didn't become fantastically rich. Of course, a few years later, McDonald's stock began trading publicly on the open market in 1965, and Ray became multi-multi-millionaire, this celebrated businessman. So, yeah, it's just the way things work, right, Jeremy?
I guess so. And all the while, there is this romance, on and off romance going on between Ray Kroc and the woman who would eventually become Joan Kroc. Introduce her to us, and how did they get to meet each other and fall in love?
Joan Kroc was a young woman playing organ in a very nice supper club in St. Paul, Minnesota. And Ray Kroc was going around the country looking for people who might be interested in opening up franchises of McDonald's. He went into this restaurant for dinner to meet the owner of the restaurant. And there was this beautiful woman playing organ at the center of the restaurant. And Ray was a pianist himself. He'd made a living as a pianist early on in his life. And so he asked to meet her, and he fell in love with her. She was married and had a young child. He was married, had been married for a very long time. And this spark flew between them. And Ray sold that boss, Joan's boss, Jim Zine, a McDonald's franchise, which Jim Zine hired Joan's husband to manage. And thus their lives entwined forever from that point forward.
But they broke up more than once. And all the while, interestingly, Joan Kroc was also in the McDonald's business with her husband.
Yeah. So her husband was so good at running this McDonald's in St. Louis Park that he got a good bonus. He was hardworking and he wanted to open his own McDonald's. And Ray said they could open their own McDonald's, Joan and her first husband, Raleigh, if they would move to Rapid City, South Dakota. They moved there and Joan worked with him, as was the case. Women weren't allowed to work front of counter in McDonald's then, but wives of owners were allowed to work, encouraged to work behind the scenes. And Joan worked behind the scenes at this Rapid City McDonald's, ordering potatoes and other supplies, helping him crew up, at first overseeing construction of the Golden Arches there. And so she was definitely in the thick of things in the early days with her husband, as her husband built this restaurant and made, as many of the early franchisees did, a really excellent living. And he did such a good job, he got the right to build another couple of McDonald's in Rapid City, too.
When Joan Kroc and Ray Kroc finally did get together for good and get married, they had a very difficult relationship. It sounds like he was drinking all the time and was abusive, and yet they stayed together. Tell us a little bit about their marriage once they finally got together.
Yeah, she finally married him in 1969, and it was very tempestuous. Joan even filed for divorce in 1971, a couple years after they did marry, and then very mysteriously decided to stay. And having been enrolled in Al-Anon and other support groups, decided to coalesce this early movement of addiction counselors. And even though she had just a high school education, she basically created an organization that made films that aired on national television and produced books and pamphlets and other outreach to help deal with the problem of addiction from the family's perspective. So she turned her pain and the difficulty of marriage with Ray into this veiled sort of asset to help other people.
The reason that I know the name Joan Kroc is because she left $200 million to National Public Radio when she died. Now, Ray Kroc, by the way, died in 1984. Joan Kroc lived until 2003. But when she died, that was one of her big donations. She also gave $1.5 billion to the Salvation Army and some money to other places as well. But why did she love NPR enough to give that much money?
Basically, she had become friendly with the local development director at KPBS because that woman's husband had been in his last days at a hospice that Joan had funded in San Diego. And Stephanie Bergsma, the director of development at KPBS, her husband had passed away in this beautiful facility. And before he died, he'd written to Joan and thanked her for building it. Hmm. And Stephanie received a call from Joan. Her husband had passed away. Joan invited her to lunch, and a friendship ensued. Joan had given some modest gifts to KPBS, and Stephanie invited Kevin Close, who was then the head of NPR, to come talk to Joan. And Joan was so dazzled by his spectacular articulation of the importance of media in a free society that she just basically fell in love with it. And posthumously, Kevin Close was the recipient of this spectacular call that said, sit down and keep writing zeros. Joan has left you an enormous sum of money.
So square that, which is just an amazing story, with the fact, as you write early in the book, that she also liked to just get on her private jet, fly to Las Vegas, and gamble $1 million away. It did seem so different of a person that would give that much money to these kinds of organizations and also, you know, fritter away money like that in Vegas.
Oh, that's what's so great about her. And, you know, every turn, I just kept thinking, I wish I could sit down with this woman because she's so fantastic. I mean, yes, it was fantastic. She was the steward of this fortune, and she felt this great responsibility to make sure that it got put to good use. But at the same time, she wasn't, you know, living a little Mother Teresa life. Not that there would have been anything wrong with it. That would have been a fantastic other story. But what was so great about her was that her favorite possession was this private plane that she had. And on it, she flew girlfriends to go shopping or gambling, but she also flew former Mayor Maureen O'Connor of San Diego to Grand Forks, North Dakota, to inform the mayor there that she was going to give an anonymous gift of $15 million as flood relief to the people who were literally drowning from the floods there. So she sent that plane around to do amazing work, both, you know, from the heart and also for fun.
That's Lisa Napoli, whose book is Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
To all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions,
the Big Mac song, and we've got an excerpt of the book at our website, hereandnow.org.
In Greece today, President Obama said the American commitment to NATO is firm. Yesterday, he said President-elect Donald Trump told him personally he would maintain a strong commitment to the alliance, even though during the campaign, Trump questioned the value of NATO. The BBC's James Reynolds joins us from Athens. And James, you were there at the press conference with Obama and Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras today. How are these assurances from President Obama about backing NATO being received there?
In public, at least, Robin, Greece believes them. Alexis Tsipras, as you mentioned, the Greek prime minister, he said in his remarks that the common links between Greece, the European Union and the United States would endure. He said he didn't know much about President-elect Trump. He hadn't read the book, The Art of the Deal, but that values would endure no matter who the president was. You kind of have to expect that he would say that in public. I think in private, you can imagine that the conversation between Mr. Obama and Mr. Tsipras was a bit more open and blunt. I'm sure they talked about what kind of president Mr. Trump will be and about how Greece can deal with that. It may be that Mr. Obama is now the accidental warm-up man for Mr. Trump, having to carry around with him the guidebook, the handbook, how to deal with President Trump.
Well, Donald Trump did say in the campaigning that, for instance, countries in NATO that didn't, you know, pay their fair share, pay into NATO, some of those countries really struggling, that the U.S. wouldn't protect.
I think Greece would say that it's not one of those countries. And indeed, President Obama thanked Greece publicly in his statements for paying its contributions, for paying 2% of its GDP towards defense spending. So Greece would say, not us, not our problem. And I think they'd also say to Donald Trump that in order for there to be a strong NATO, there needs to be an involved United States as well. Greece has been always been worried about its position on the edge of Europe. And it's seen over the last year and a half, of course, what that position means, the influx of refugees and migrants from Syria and other countries. In other words, what happens in the Middle East, what happens on NATO's borders really does matter to Greece.
What other questions did the reporters have? Because they were almost all about the new president.
I was surprised that there were a couple of questions about the economy. Mm-hmm. And in some ways now, President Obama, even though he's got 2 months left, is almost a political analyst, a political commentator, because he speaks only with 2 months of power in his pocket. And everyone knows that in New York at the moment, President-elect Trump has 4 years of power in his pocket. So you can see power draining away mm-hmm. from an outgoing president, as we've seen every 8 years recently.
Well, wondering if there's any conversation there about the fact that Russia ended a ceasefire in Syria, launching a new airstrike offensive, hitting Homs, Idlib, but also Aleppo, which has been so pounded. And this happened, this airstrike began not long after Russian President Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, the president-elect, spoke by phone. Are people there asking about U.S.-Russia relations?
There's no point talking about NATO unless you also talk about Russia. I think it's interesting that when Syriza, when the movement here in Greece came to power in 2015, there was some talk that it might have its own approach to Russia. But I think Greece is by and large lined up with the position of both the European Union and NATO. And clearly it hopes that the incoming U.S. administration will do the same.
The BBC's James Reynolds in Athens after President Obama's press conference there today, his first visit on his last foreign tour. James, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. It's a pleasure to join you on your program.
One of the areas where there are sure to be a lot of differences in policy when President-elect Trump takes office is energy and the environment. And environmentalists are very concerned. Joining us now is Annie Leonard, Executive Director of Greenpeace USA. She's on Skype in San Francisco. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And what are you most worried about with a Trump presidency when it comes to the environment?
Everything. It would be easier for me to say what I am not worried about. Trump's potential to dismantle and go backwards on 50 years of environmental progress is a very, very real threat.
And when you say that, what are you talking about specifically?
Well, the most pressing issue is climate. Under Obama's leadership, finally, the United States has gotten serious about climate, and we are participating in a major global agreement about climate called the Paris Agreement, which is the first sign of hope we've seen in a very long time. Trump is threatening to pull out of that agreement, which would be a disaster both for the United States' reputation and also for our climate progress. He is also threatening to support coal. He is threatening to open up public lands for drilling. He's threatening to underfund or even dismantle the EPA. He's stacking his cabinet with incredibly fossil fuel friendly appointees. I mean, it is really bad in every direction that we look.
Well, let's go through some of the things you just brought up, starting with the Paris deal. Is it as easy as he is saying it will be to just cancel the U.S. participation in the Paris Climate Agreement?
It's not something he could do imminently, but he could imminently say that that is what he is going to do. And in fact, there are representatives from countries all around the world meeting today in Morocco about the agreement. And I've heard from my team on the ground there that there's very strong rumors that he is planning to either today or tomorrow announce his intention to leave. While bureaucratically, it would take a while for him to actually leave, there are lots of ways that he could leave. De facto, he could refuse to send representatives to the meetings. He could refuse our financial pledge to help less industrialized countries get on board. He could refuse to implement the steps needed to make our commitment real. There's lots of ways he can withdraw, even without legally withdrawing, because that does take a couple of years.
What about on the issue of coal? We've heard for years about the coal industry moving over to more clean coal technology. Would they just stop doing that under a President Trump? Or what are you most worried about when it comes to coal?
Well, I think on coal, Trump actually has put himself into a corner because he has gone to Appalachia and said he will end the war on coal. He will bring back coal jobs. The truth is, it's not environmental regulations that have decimated the coal market. It's that coal is really expensive and really dirty, and it's just cheaper to go for natural gas. So he really can't end the war on coal because it's market forces working against coal. The era of coal is over. And what he should be doing is promising those communities training and investment in clean energy jobs, because that's where the world is going. One thing Trump seems to not realize is he can't actually change or stop global forces. And whether we're talking about the Paris Agreement or we're talking about the decline of coal, these things are happening and he will do his best to slow them down. But the world is marching on.
What about the issue of drilling? You brought that up as well, that he may open up more areas to drilling. What are you most worried about there?
Right now, about half of the public lands in the United States have some kind of protection against oil, gas, and coal drilling or mining. He is promising to remove all those protections and open up 100% of our public lands for drilling. Now, that's a problem, of course, for the ecosystems where the drilling is happening. It will decimate forests and wildlands and habitat. That will be a horrible ecological problem. But even worse, the climate simply cannot afford much more drilling and burning of this fossil fuel. I mean, we are really at the top of our carbon budget. And right now, all investments need to be to move away from fossil fuels, not expand them.
So what are you going to do to try to stop him from doing that?
We are going to resist like you have never seen Greenpeace resist before. We are working with organizations across the movement, not just environmental organizations, but immigrant rights organizations, women rights organizations. All different kinds of organizations are coming together and saying that we will be more united than ever and put up an absolute a wall of resistance, we are calling it, against any rollbacks on climate, any rollbacks on environment, any rollbacks on gay rights, on immigrant rights. We are really going to stand together and not allow him to take our country back to the dark ages.
The last thing that you brought up, and this is something that has worried a lot of environmentalists, is the people that he's surrounding himself on the environmental issues, and particularly somebody named Myron Ebell, who is a climate denier. Now, Donald Trump himself has put out a tweet, you know, a while back saying that he thought that climate change was a hoax from the Chinese. But how do you convince people who have said that they don't believe climate change is happening that it is, in order to take that first step to get them to try to do some of the things that you want them to do?
Well, I think that Trump's appointees are very, very telling. It really pulls the rug out under the argument of let's wait and see what he does and see if we can work with him. From the day after the election, he has started appointing people who not just deny climate, but vehemently deny climate. And, you know, personnel is policy. He, with each of these appointments, he is indicating the kind of future he wants. The good news is that very few people want this kind of future. Even though Trump won the election, remember, he did not win the popular vote. And even more people didn't vote at all than voted for Trump. And a lot of these people want a clean energy economy. They want a safe and fair society. And we're just going to keep building that. The deniers will leave them in the dust because there are more of us that want a better future than don't.
That's Annie Leonard, Executive Director of Greenpeace USA. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Vermont is known for maple syrup, ice cream, and craft beer. Now some Vermont investors are banking on the state's next niche export. It's called CBD, or cannabidiol. It's made from the hemp plant, and it's a potential health supplement. John Kalish reports.
A company called Green Mountain CBD planted a little less than 5 acres of hemp this June in Hardwick, Vermont. Its first crop did well, and now a mixture of coconut oil and hemp are being made into capsules at a Long Island pharmaceutical factory. Although the Food and Drug Administration has barred pill makers from saying there are health benefits to CBD, the substance is believed by many consumers to be effective in treating a variety of medical problems, including arthritis and epilepsy.
There seems to be some kind of gold rush around CBD oil. I'm watching a lot of people raise money and spend way too much money to make something that grows pretty simply by itself.
Green Mountain CBD's CEO, Alejandro Brigad, is a veteran of the Colorado hemp industry. Brigad says the first batch of CBD capsules made with Vermont hemp will sell for half the price of most CBD capsules currently on the market.
We believe we're farming more efficiently than anybody in the country in terms of dollars in and milligrams of CBD out.
Green Mountain CBD is a three-man operation with a greenhouse and processing facility. It impressed an investment group that includes two of Vermont's most successful businessmen. Alan Newman, who started the green cleaning supplies company Seventh Generation, and this guy.
What we're trying to do is focus on building a foundation for an industry in Vermont. I think what we're talking about here is the process of helping a new sector of the economy emerge.
That's Will Rapp, the founder of the Gardeners Supply Company and one of the principals in Evergreen Capital. Rapp wants Green Mountain CBD to grow 5 acres of hemp on a farm that he hopes will be the centerpiece of a soon-to-be-formed Vermont Center for Botanical Excellence.
We're hoping to break ground next month on a five-acre grow. Now, if we do that, we're going to need a drying facility. We're going to need a testing facility. We're going to need a processing facility.
With a $250,000 investment from Evergreen Capital, Green Mountain CBD plans to double its acreage and hire more workers. CEO Alejandro Burgad says demand for his company's CBD capsules has been growing. Customers include parents who have been giving CBD to their autistic children.
As we help people, people talk about it, and we're really seeing a grassroots spreading of the word.
More than three-quarters of the hemp crops grown in Colorado and Kentucky are going to CBD production, says Eric Steenstra, the executive director of the Hemp Industries Association. He recently attended a meeting of the North Carolina Industrial Hemp Commission.
They're in the process now of creating regulations and are hoping to have an industry next growing season. Just this year alone, we had seven or eight new states that opened up hemp programs, so I expect that to continue.
Steenstra expects national sales for CBD products to exceed $100 million this year. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Technology stocks have taken a dive since Donald Trump's election. In a note to investors yesterday, UBS said companies like Facebook, Amazon, and Google may struggle in 2017. The president-elect was a vocal critic of some of Silicon Valley's biggest names, and his positions on immigration and trade are at odds with the tech industry. Let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is a senior editor at Recode. He joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Peter, hi.
Hello. How are you?
And broadly, I'm fine. And broadly speaking, markets are as well. You know, they've since risen after Trump's election, but not the tech sector. Shares of Amazon off 8%. Facebook dropped 5%. What's the mood in Silicon Valley?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's like the rest of the country, and it's a little confused. You know, in terms of the market and what it thinks about various tech stocks, I think each of those is probably a different story. I think Apple's in a very different place than Google is if you're sort of sketching out what next year looks like in a Trump administration.
Yeah. But people, I think, are wondering if the markets are taking a message from Trump. He's gone after Amazon for antitrust issues. In February, he slammed Apple and its CEO, Tim Cook, after that company refused to unlock the iPhone that belonged to the shooter in San Bernardino. Let's listen.
Boycott Apple. Here's the thing. First of all, the phone's not even owned by this young thug that killed all these people. The phone's owned by the government. Okay, not even his phone. We don't even have to go that far. But Tim Cook is looking to do a big number, probably to show how liberal he is.
So, Peter, there's that. Then there's also the concern over Donald Trump's stance on immigration and his position on trade. Remind us.
Donald Trump's obviously been saber-rattling towards countries like Mexico and China. China's very important for Apple, and obviously is taking a very hard line on immigration and threatening to deport millions of people from America. Generally, Silicon Valley has wanted to get more immigrants. You might want to distinguish between the kinds of immigrants Silicon Valley wants to bring in versus the kind Donald Trump's saying he wants to kick out. But they're all broadly in the same category right now.
Well, and we're hearing people from Silicon Valley say that they have workers waiting for special visas for high-tech workers. I think they're called condoed in Vancouver. They're stuck in condos up in Vancouver waiting to get into the country to work in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard to sort of figure out how much of what Donald Trump said he actually believes and how much he believes he's actually going to spend energy on trying to enforce next year. You know, he didn't spend a lot of time railing against the immigrants taking high-end jobs in Silicon Valley. That's not sort of the root of his populist message, if we want to use populist as the right adjective.
Yeah.
So it may be that the sort of the market's fears about what he's going to do or not do to Silicon Valley are misplaced. I wouldn't be surprised if he tries to poke at Amazon, though, and Jeff Bezos. I mean, Jeff Bezos is one of the few people who run a big Silicon Valley company, or at least high-tech company, who've taken a stance against Donald Trump. Very few people have actually gone ahead and done that, and Jeff Bezos is one of those.
Well, Trump has gone after China as a currency manipulator. He wants to slap tariffs on Chinese products. That's a big deal because Silicon Valley does a lot of business with China. That's how many of us afford our, smartphones. 22% of Apple's revenue in the last fiscal year came from China.
So
right again, it's a big deal for Apple. If you want to get nuanced about it, China's a big deal for Apple. If trade halts there or slows there, that's a big deal for them. Facebook and Google aren't really doing any business in China. They've had problems in China for many years, so there's no obvious effect that would have there. You could just argue that it's all broadly bad for an industry that's based on sort of global connection.
Yeah. The San Francisco Chronicle makes the point this week that if Donald Trump wants to make good on his promise to boost the U.S. economy to 4% output, he needs Silicon Valley, because that kind of growth only comes from a big event or tech innovation, the car or the internet. So is there a feeling that Trump might recognize that and maybe soften?
You know, again, I don't really know what he wants to do. I think that he imagines he's gonna make people go back to work by building giant walls and maybe fixing highways. He hasn't really shown really much interest in Silicon Valley except as sort of a thing to beat on. He does have Peter Thiel working for him, one of the most prominent people in Silicon Valley. And, you know, if you really want to play this out, there is sort of a through line here between Silicon Valley and some of Trump's policies. There is a strong libertarian streak through a lot of Silicon Valley, too, of its most prominent and successful companies the last few years, Uber and Airbnb, have succeeded by sort of taking on established businesses and sort of flouting regulations. And so maybe they can find some common ground there.
You talk about PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel, a big booster of Donald Trump, also a controversial figure. He helped fund Hulk Hogan's libel lawsuit against Gawker after Gawker outed him as gay. He also is gay and on Trump's transition team. And your own Recode's Kara Swisher takes him on for not challenging Trump's other appointments, like Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, who's been hostile to homosexuals. How do you think that issue, gay rights and Silicon Valley and Peter Thiel, what's going to happen there?
You know, Peter Thiel confuses Silicon Valley in the same way I think that Donald Trump confuses Silicon Valley. I think the question for both people is what does Peter Thiel really want? It's hard to sort of tell. He's sort of famous for playing the long game. He brought down Gawker after sort of plotting against them in a years-long campaign. Thiel said to the National Press Club and to others that you should take Donald Trump seriously, not literally. And the real question for Silicon Valley and the rest of the country is how is that what is that going to look like in practice in the next few months and years?
That's been the saying. His supporters take him seriously, but not literally. Peter Kafka,
exactly.
Senior editor at Recode, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.